daybreak in the morning, it was absolutely in the birth sea, and it was hard to, you know, you couldn't explain to people. You'd hear people, cars going off to work, and you say, them poor old devils, you know, and you're sitting out there and you're enjoying, and you're getting a few fish, and, you know, it was absolutely lovely.
There were some great seasons then as well, like in them days. I heard my grandmother saying in 1927, from the first day they went out to fish till the last day that they never missed a tide without getting fish.
Well, the Green Diver, that was one of the most famous boats. It's still in Gregna Manor, but when you look back on the history of the old regattas all over the place, or for the racing cuts, the Green Diver was always nearly first.
They have their stories, you know, and the other thing I'd say is that the cot style, there's no other boat construction type. It's unique to this particular set of rivers. There's no other place in Europe they build boats specifically like this. They haven't actually, the core boat hasn't been copied from anywhere else. It developed on these rivers.
It's kind of lost in time, I think. The way we look at it now, it was another world. That's actually the way it was, another world completely. The cot racing, the fishing, the whole lot. When we look back on it all now, it was kind of another world, you know.
In the southeast of Ireland, on the Barrow Nor and Shore rivers, there is a boat that connects us directly with our ancestors. A long, narrow vessel, the cot has been used on the tidal stretches of these waters, mostly to fish with snap nets for salmon. Cots are not simply boats. Their lineage is a rich one, as is that of the cot men who fished and built and raced them. Francis Walsh is a fourth generation cot man.
Will we try to draw down? I think we'll, from a little above port's height, and until we meet we'll turn around then and fish back.
You could be going a long time before you meet it.
Well, I had a time for 6:15 or 6:30 from the tide last night. Which I don't know. The tides are unpredictable, these ones are, because they were St. James' spring tides, you know.
So it hasn't turned yet?
No, it hasn't turned. It's still flowing down, look.
Yeah, yeah.
See the little flow on it? Yeah. Okay, Kieran, hop in there. This is Clogarry's Quay here now. The biggest quay is on the whole of the River Barrow, apart from St. Mullins. Yeah, the finest quay is on it. It was used one time, there was a mill in there, Cushion's Mill, originally Cushendale Woolen Mills in Gregna Manor. All came out of that place just there, at the back of that stream. That's the mill race stream. We'll be letting out there in the middle of the stream, just there, in the middle of the gap, and we'll be just fishing tight off up. And then we'll be heading out across to the canal side and off up in the holes, up along.
Literary evidence we have from around the time the Normans, there is notice that for payment of one penny, they had, the cotmen had right of navigation.
Marine archaeologist Dorina Tully has studied the cots extensively and tells me that their name suggests a Stone Age predecessor.
The actual word cot itself is an indication. Its origins probably came from dugout. It's similar to the word coed in Welsh, which means from wood, or coit in Irish. So they obviously have this long lineage going back. They most likely developed out of the dugouts. But the snap net fishing itself is also very ancient that they do. And it's probably one of the oldest forms of fishery, a straight net between two boats.
We're paddling to the head of the drift and we're going to separate the cots.
Fishing cots work in pairs with a net suspended between them and either a 4 or 2 man crew.
Okay, shake it up. Okay.
A bottom rope is dropped to the riverbed, creating a bag in the water as the cots drift in parallel.
We're right on the bottom there now.
With much of the fishing done at night, the fisherman relied on his senses, and at the first pull of a fish, the ropes are gathered and the net is snapped shut. Watching the cot men work, it certainly feels like ancient practice. But since the 1950s, conservation measures, the advent of farmed salmon, and a lack of new crews on the river have seen this traditional activity slowly decline.
Just tipping along with the tide.
Snapnet fishing for salmon was banned on the Three Rivers in 2006. In the last two seasons, the Nore and Shore reopened, with fishing licences granted to the small number of cutmen remaining. The Barrow is still closed.
No, come on this way, Mary. We get this one better. You might be able to see it better now. Mind yourself coming across here now. There's briars there again.
At one time, hundreds of cots lined the riverbanks, resting in what were known as stocks. Jamesy Murphy, a cotman on the Nore, brought me to unearth the remains of one.
That's where the stocks was, in by the wall, as you can see, the old stake for tying the cot. But years and years ago, cots were never tied. They were just pulled up and anchored with the gadpole and the front pole. And there was never a lock put on a cot, because everybody sort of trusted each other. I dare say it wouldn't happen now, but how's ever. So that's your stocks there. Two cots would be there side by side. And on the high water, of course, you just walk into the cot. On the low water, they would walk down their path of stones and into the cot and just slide the cot back out on the mud into the river. That place could talk now, could tell some stories already. Well, I started in the river at 12-year-old in 1948. Oh, I went out with the next door neighbour, one of the greatest cotmen of all time, a man called Tom Lacey. And he was the champion of the Barrow Nore and Shore for years. And of course, it was like everything. It was like being a sub in a hurling team. He needed a sub and I was next door to him. So he said, come on, I'll show you the ropes. So that's how it all started. But all my ancestors, all the Murphys, uncles and grandfather and the whole lot of them, they were all involved in fishing.
Mary, start up your little machine.
It's a new day and Francis brings me on a tour of his old fishing grounds. Like most cotmen, he is practiced in a unique vocabulary of river names. Having grown up on the river, he knows every inch of this waterway.
I didn't go snapnet fishing now straight away. I had a brother, John, who was a crewman for a long time with my father. John moved on to another crew, so it was my turn then to go fish with my father, and he was going to train me in. But I remember one evening I fished down too tight, and I got the front of the cot, caught into Sally's on him. We were fishing too tight. And I was only young at the time, I was only about 8 or 9 years of age. And we were there stuck in it for a few minutes, and he says to me, are you going to put down the paddle in the water and take me back out? He says to me, and I says, I will, yeah. And he says, you want to do it soon? He says, we're losing valuable fishing. So you learned the hard way. You were taught the hard way how to do it. So now we're outside of an area here now known as the Head of Charlie's Hole. Just that area, just as we're looking in, we're after coming down past the Cripple's Cottage, and the next place is the Head of Charlie's Hole, and this is actually the middle of Charlie's Hole here, where this little rock area here is. And as you move down further, just when you're coming out of it is the tail of Charlie's Hole. You'd need to know the names. You'd need to know exactly where you were fishing into, because if you missed, if you happen to fish too tightly into that place there now, just that little place was known as the middle in there. But if you fish too tightly in there, the net would simply get caught in it fast. But the fishermen knew exactly where they all were. They tell you when to take up the net, they tell you when to keep out, they tell you when to fish it lightly, and they tell you to, when to let it back. A lot of the old names are Irish. They were named long time before I got near the river, I'll tell you that. We had no names on the river until we learned them all from the fishermen, from the likes of Tommy Welsh and from Jimmy the Red Welsh and from my father.
They were all sort of related to the area that they were in. You know, for instance, Port Ganiva, Port Ganya they called it, up in Dysart Moor. That was the sandy bank, and which was in actual fact a sandy bank. You know, then you had the Barna coming down, which was the gap coming out in the river. Then you had Port Glass, Port Glass as the old fishermen called it, but it was really Port Glass, the green bank. You came down further then and you had Paulnagutta, and the old fishermen called it Paulukta. And heading on down then to the confluence of the two rivers, the Bar and the Nore, you had the Nore.
Then you have Colgrew, means Red Rock, of course, and then you have Paulnagutta, and you have Cremogan. You have the long Rich, as we call it there.
Pearl of Book,
yeah. The Long Rich, as you call it there. Well, I believe that's the Long Reach.
Mike Jones and Peter Welch are cotmen on the shore. Peter begins by explaining how fishing carved the landscape here.
If you go along and look at the geography of the whole place here, there's a road leading to the river about every mile away. So I suppose it was all small farmers and fishermen in the Carrageen, yeah, / Mounkeen area. And the tradition is kept alive here in this particular area, in that pocket of South Kilkenny. In 1957, I paddled a man by the name of Jim Power here, four-man crew, here in Granny. And then after that, we went two-man. But of course, the two-man didn't start in 1945. A man by the name of Neddy Power and Andy Rowe, two Ballygorry men, they went into Waterford to see a film. It was coming to the end of the war years, and at that particular time they were there used to be an interval. I couldn't tell you whether there are intervals in films now, but there used to be an interval then at that particular time, and Patio News used to come on. Do you remember that?
That's right, yeah.
In films. But during the interval, these two little lads came along and they appeared to be operating a small net, and what they thought they were, it was like little tubs they had. What it transpired to be is that Corrigal fishing in Wales. So when they came home anyway, I needn't tell you, they didn't speak too much about the film that they went in to see. I think they were saying, oh God, those two lads are able to operate these nets, one in each boat. So they decided then that they'd go fish two-man. They were the very first two people that started two-man crews. So they weren't greatly accepted the first year.
A lot of the four-man crew used to be laughing at us, saying that we were only dirty in the farm, you know, but they decided then that we were getting more fish and we hadn't to pay two more fellas, you know, you were making more money. So they all got into it.
John Cantwell was one of the early adopters of the two-man system on the shore.
But you'd make a crew with a fella, you see. You say, will we go together? And you keep your word then. You fish every tide. You know, you'd be getting up all hours and day and night and morning. You're out. You wouldn't get much sleep now. You're only home, and then you have to sell the fish and you get the fish buyers and maybe mend a net. And you don't get much time for the bed, and you'd know it at the end of the week. But that time now, they had no such thing as oil skins, or only a pair of brogues and probably bad ones, and a bag they used to have on their shoulders, a sack, and a sack on their knees. They were all hard working, poor old fellas, you know, they used to. It's the only thing they had. And if the fishing was good, they'd make a few pounds and they'd get a stitch of clothes or buy something. Probably get a bit of meat, which they mightn't have for the rest of the year.
There were some great seasons then as well, in them days. In 1927, they were buying fish in Ballinlough Creamery, that's in Mounkeen. And in a good season, there could be at least three tank fulls of salmon every day. That was the, and it was all exported. It was all sent to Billingsgate
in England.
Yeah, in England.
I suppose all fishermen are said to be superstitious, but cotmen have particular things, don't they?
They have, yes. Well, I could tell you four different true stories. There was one man there who used to be going fishing, and when he was fishing, if it's a thing, he got fish with his oil coat on.
Well, he would not take off the oil coat for the day, even though if the sun was splitting the rocks.
Melting him.
But there was another character up there. If he was fishing, if he was getting a lot of fish, and at that stage the lads asked him for a light, light a cigarette. He'd give him a light, all right, but he'd only give him half a match. He wouldn't give him a full match. Under any circumstances, wouldn't give him a full match. Because if he gave him a full match, his luck was gone.
Yeah.
For the day.
Yeah,
for the week.
That was...
Now, if he was getting no fish, and you were getting fish, he'd come into you looking for a box of matches off of you, so that he'd take your luck, and then he'd say, I have all his luck gone now. I have his box of matches gone, and I'm going to get fish from here on in.
Yeah.
They're terrible.
You don't like changing your wellies, do you?
No, I don't. No, if I'd have played a pair of black Wellingtons, and I have a pair of green Wellingtons on me, and if I was getting fish with the green Wellingtons, there's no way I'd.
You'd wear them going to bed.
I'd nearly wear them going to mass. I would. There's no way I'd take off the Wellingtons.
Oh yeah.
That's a true story.
So why did you love fishing here with your dad?
I don't know, this place always had a kind of a sentiment for us. I think we always paddled up here to the head of the drifts here. We love this area to fish in here, especially down by the Cripple's Cottage. It was a beautiful place to fish in. But I remember we were fishing a night here, and my father was just after getting a new cart built with the Bryans, and it was a lovely moonlight night. And we pulled in the 17-pound salmon. Four-man crew again, we closed the cots. Everything was absolutely done perfectly. And just as he took the fish in, the fish broke a mesh in the net, or possibly two meshes in the net. And the fish ran straight up into the head of the cot. My father followed him up on his hands and knees. He got one stroke at him in the cap of the cot, but unfortunately he struck the cap of the cot, and the fish got back under his legs, and he followed him back again into the cart. And we were watching this going on, and next thing he got another stroke at him, but missed the fish again and struck his thumb. And would that, he struck his thumb, and the fish jumped straight out into the river, out over the cap of the cart, into the river, and nobody said anything. We were all a little bit excited. Nobody said anything. There was no giving out done. But next thing we saw the fish, he jumped, let one big jump up into the middle of the river, and he leapt about absolutely a yard or two up into the river. And then all silent then for a minute again, and next thing he turned another big jump in the middle of the river. And my father just turned around and he says, oh, do you know something? He says, you just couldn't credit. He says, that never happened to me ever before. Well, the curses on that fish that night. And his tongue was swollen for about a week after.
Cod Fisher Kings, a documentary on the tradition of cod fishing and racing on the Barrow Nor and Shore, continues.
See, down here now, Mary, we have the Bridge Street steps. This was where the Ross fishermen, as they were called, came in and took out their bags of fish and just walked across the street up to the store. It's a lovely day down here, but unfortunately, as you can see, Murphy's is closed up, long since gone. That was the bar and grocery end of it there, and the fish store was around the corner.
So this is the door. You pressed on the bell there. If this big door, main door, wasn't open, the minute you brought in your fish was weighed, you saw him being weighed. You saw the weight of your fish. If he was 9.5 pound, that's what you got, 9.5 pound down on your docket.
You're dead right, Francis, because I have here a docket from the 4th of the 8th, 1990. Francis Welsh Balavara. Three fish, 14-pound salmon at 190, 4.5-pound peel at 160, and a 7-pound peel at 150. Total value, 44.30.
That's right.
Pounds. Pounds. Not a bad night's work.
A nice night's work. John Murphy told me himself that all his fish were sent that time to Italy and to France, where all the film stars at the time were all on holiday from Hollywood, and they were eating all the fish from the Barron Orne Shore rivers.
John was the last of his ilk, shall we say. His grandfather was probably the first to start up the salmon business there. There were great people to look after the fishermen, because things weren't so good at that stage. And even if you hadn't enough money to buy the license, exactly, to fish, Murphy would buy the license for you and take back the money that was spent in installments. So at the end of the season, the books were balanced. And he always looked after everyone. There was always a little, what shall we say, sweetener, if you like, to bring the fish into Murphy's. Of course, the older fellas who would like a drink, they always got a half one and a small bottle of stout. If you were a woman coming in with the fish, you went in and you got a bottle of lemonade and a packet of biscuits.
In the cruise at that time, the fishing and that, well, the mother seemed to have the handling of the money, like, you know, didn't they?
Yeah, well, of course, at that particular stage, she sold the fish. She brought the fish down to Carrageen Creamery.
Yeah.
They were the most important part of it, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, they were, yeah.
Because if it was left to some of the men, there wouldn't be a copper in it the week after that.
Well,
it would be all gone. Yeah. I remember then when they gave up buying the fish in the creamery. Kathleen Fiore, now she'd be Kathleen Roach.
Yeah,
she told him, it's hard to believe this, but they used to, she used to put the fish in the pony and car up in Carrageen and go into town. So that's 7 miles with a pony and car and the fish in the back of it. Sure, that woman was going all day. Again, she was in Waterford and back again, sure, the day was whatever few pennies she had.
The women handled most of the money.
But you got a bit of it when you got your car, didn't you?
I did. I remember I fished for about a whole week. I was young at the time, and I was coming up to, I suppose, what, John was after emigrating to England at the time, and we were fishing away then between ourselves, myself and Kieran and my father. And there was another chap from Ross used to fish with us at the time, James Wickham. I kept a good bit of the fishing money for the week. And I went off and I bought a new car. There was great fishing that time. Bought a new car. The price of a new car that time was about £2,200, I think it was. And I bought the car out of fishing that time. But I wasn't forgiven for it for a long time because I had held the money. So I had to fish a lot of nights after that and weeks after that to pay back the money that I had taken out of the crew. And I wasn't forgiven for a good while for it. It was just that the way it was. Well, but it was the one time I got my hand on the money. But I need to say, I didn't get my hand on it for a long, long time after that.
So do you think your father was, like, he saw the value of passing it on? Like,
he did. Most fishermen did see the value of passing it on, because I'd say they actually, from a long time out, I'd say they saw the tradition of the fishing dying the whole time, you know. And I'd say even in the 80s and 90s, when my father was still fishing with us, and right up into 2004 he fished, probably 2003, about 3 years before he died, he fished right with us, you know. But I remember the last night he fished, and we struck out at the mud of the Raven. That night there was no crew at all on the river, and the river was absolute calm. There wasn't a ripple on the river that night. And we were struck in at the mud of the Raven, and he says, I think this fishing is dying, he says. And I said, how will you make out that? Well, he said, on this stretch of river one time, he said, there was 17 and 18 four-man crews, he says, that fished from St. Mullins, he says, to Cool Hill Quay, and to down past the Castle Pond. And he says, now tonight, he says, we're here on our own. Yeah, and that was a kind of the real last of the four-man crew fishing that he'd done with us. That was actually his last night fishing.
A cot on the water is a beautiful thing. The men who built them weren't trained naval architects building from any plan. Rather, these master craftsmen built from a store of knowledge that developed in these river communities over generations. An almost instinctive capacity to bring simple wooden constructs to life. Shipwright Michael Kennedy
traces the evolution of the designs and what the boat builders of the Three Rivers were trying to achieve.
There's no other place in Europe they built boats specifically like this. They haven't actually, the core boat hasn't been copied from anywhere else. It developed on these rivers. Here they were fishing on the river, conditions on the river, the gear they were using had a big impact on how the boats were constructed. They were looking for stability, but they were also looking for lightness, you know, because they had to haul the boats in or out. And they were looking for wear as well. They did not particularly want a fancy racing cot design like Cuddity was producing, because it would have been no good to them. In the end of the day, it's human muscle that operates these boats, so that's the parameter you work within, you know. And they had great skills in that, and great knowledge.
The cots that were designed down here, they're fishing the waters down here for hundreds and hundreds of years, so they're well tested. The traditional cot was 19 and a half foot long. That was the cot with the four-man crew. She was a two-stem cot.
Yeah.
But nowadays, with the two-man crew, she has to be at least 16 foot long. The reason for that is the waves, they're about 8 or 10 foot between each wave. And, of course, if she was any smaller, she'd go under. She have to be floating on top of two waves at all times. That's the theory for that.
Out of the fishing cot, the racing cot championships developed, and they had super championship racing cots at one stage. And they were down in New Ross. They were paddled in New Ross in the early 1900s. And they were paddled here in the ferry in the early 1900s, 1909, I think.
Way back in the 1930s, you had the Glen St. Saul regatta down here. And then you had the regatta in New Ross. Invariably in New Ross, all the cot races were run before the main events, which were the boat races. And they'd have the fishing cot races, and then they'd have the racing cot races, and then they'd have the championship of the Barranore and Shore. And then you had the Ferrymount Garrett regatta, and then you had Greignamana. Greignamana stretched back to the late 1800s. And then you had St. Mullins. Or as all the fellas around here used to call it when they'd be going up, they were going to Similins.
St. Mullins was a lovely flat course, similar to this here. You had nice flat water, very little wind on it. You'd always be tense before you go out in a race, and you'd feel a little bit of, you'd have butterflies in your stomach. So it's almost going out like in a game of hurling or football, maybe. You'd be a little bit tense when you go. But once you get out in the river then, and once you got going and a few practice strokes in, it was great. But they were competitive days. You wouldn't give an inch to each other on the rivers. They were really competitive days, you know. And the men on the Nore were great paddlers too. We'd have to hand them that. We're right on the Ferrymount Garrett Bridge. Just as you look there, there's the platform for the regatta. The greasy pole was out opposite, out right on the middle of that there, out in the river. And they used to do the pillow fighting there with two pillows and two lads flailing each other off the pole. You'd hear the microphones all over the river about when the races were starting, and all the little races, about five or six car races, was run from that little platform there. That's the second regatta stage, just under the hill. There's the first one, the very first regatta stage, back in the early 1900s, was run from that little platform there. You see, there's one, two, three, four. Four posts sticking out, and there's still some of the transom post on the top, and the edge going around it. And you see the weeds.
Cod Fisher Kings, a documentary on the tradition of cod fishing and racing on the Barrow, Nore and Shore, continues. Regattas were hugely popular events in 1800s Ireland, with racing crews coming from around the country and sometimes England to compete. In the southeast, the humble fishing cot found its place among these boat races. But the craft found its purest expression in the racing cot, a vessel built specifically for speed and racing. The Dornawn, the Carrick Shock, the Shore Lass, the Green Diver, just some of the names that were to become legend amongst the cotmen.
The last time all the racing cots were out together on the river, the last time they were all out was 1952 in St. Mullins. The Dornawn was a racing cot, an uncle of mine, Mick Welsh, used to paddle on, Jimmy Cody, same old. That cot was 27 foot 6 inches long. The Barons used to have the Carrick Shock racing cot. She was the shortest racing cot of all. She was only 21 foot in length. A similar measurement to the fishing cot. Then you had the Green Diver. The Green Diver was a 26 foot cot. made by Tom Taylor at Mile Bush.
Or the Green Diver, that was one of the most famous boats. It's still in Greigna Manor, but when you look back on the history of the old regattas all over the place, invariably in the Championship of the Barra Nor and Shore, or for the racing cots, the Green Diver was always nearly first.
The first paddlers ever were, I think, a man by the name of Larry Murphy and Martin Taylor. But Larry Murphy actually got drowned out of the cot and lost his life out of it.
An uncle of mine, Larry Murphy, they were practising for a regatta in Uras, and the cot upset, and Larry couldn't swim, and the Taylor man could swim like a rat. But unfortunately, for some reason or other, he made for the bank and left Larry in the middle of the river, and unfortunately he drowned.
So what happened then was the Taylors are kind of emigrated out of Ballinock when Larry Murphy got drowned out of the cart, and the family seemed to have emigrated completely. The Taylors were no more kind of in Ballinock, but Tom Taylor was renowned as a very, very good cart builder.
Hi, Tommy. Hi, Seamus. How are you keeping?
On a July evening in Thomastown, I meet with artist Shem Caulfield. New cots were being built around Kilkenny as part of a leader-funded programme to revive the tradition, and Shem was taking me to see progress on two racing cots his group was building from the lines of the Carrick Shock. If completed, it would be the first time in decades since a new racing cot had hit the water. But first, there was some treasure to see.
That's the Nora Lass over there. And originally, the whole idea was, my particular interest would have been to try and make a replica of her, you know, to try and understand it. And but even though we had Michael Kennedy working with us, a renowned boat builder, she proved very complex, extremely complex thing to make. She was always known, seemingly, as a very, very giddy boat. I imagine quite a beautiful thing in the water, you know.
Michael Kennedy told me more about this 100-year-old Nora Lass and how she had come to light.
Tradition is never a dead hand, you know, it's always an evolving process. You know, cot building, it's kind of been staggering for a while, since I'd say the 50s, as you had a generation of active builders, and then they were fading out and they weren't being replaced. We were just looking around to see if any of them had survived. We heard a rumour that the boat existed and was in a shed, and we went to see it with the owner's consent, and I couldn't believe how complete she was. I mean, she's much more complete than the Green Diver.
Well, most of the set out work is already done on her.
Cuddity had his own signature, and that's what you see in the Nora Lass, and that's why it's very important to preserve the original artefact. The Green Diver, different builder, different style, you know, it's a very competitive scene, you know, it's like Ferrari don't build the same as Maserati, you know, essentially, you know.
When is this to be ready for?
Oh yeah, well, our plan is, what have we got, the 13th of July? To be ready for the Greig Regatta on the bank holiday, August bank holiday.
And who's racing her?
Yeah, well, we'll have to pick. I won't be in it anyway because, you know, although I've had the honour of finishing Tour to Francie Walsh once, but I've only saw the back of his head most of the time. Although I'd like Francie to have a go, you know. I was talking to him there the other day and he declined, but maybe I'll get around him and get him to navigate or to pilot one of these, you know, with some. Yeah, but he is, as I say, it's like Kilkenny. He's a lot of titles under his belt, and maybe he doesn't want to risk a new boat that he's not, you know, used to being in.
The cots under construction looked lovely, but leaving the workshop that evening, it was the Nora Lass that stayed with me. I wanted to find out more about her builder, Tom Cudahy, a name I'd been hearing over and over. That led me to his grandson, also Tom Cudahy.
Now, the shed is down here. This was they say that my grandfather, who died in 1944, built most of his cots. And many people have come and gone since, but his legacy still lives on. Now, in the olden days, most of the local people were into fishing, and it was the main source of revenue for a lot of people. But on top of that, they had to be able to mend their cots and mend their nets. But he had a particular craft because people noticed that and came for their specific type of boat. Like, it was like going to a cobbler years ago. He made your shoe, but he made their boat. It was for fishing or racing. And that time, a lot of fellas spent time at regattas. It was a big thing, you know what I mean, at the turn of the century, where you spent your Sunday racing a cot. Maybe hurling was just getting going. But he rowed himself. He had a famous boat, the Island Maid, which he won the championship of the Shurnor in Barrow. So he was able to find out the faults of the boats by meeting other fellas. And he developed along the line then as he got older. And people came from far and near, particularly Greig na Mana and Inistaigh. They were all into racing cots there. When the boats were done now, this would be the door that they were brought out now. And they were carried down the road and down to a laneway here, just down to the left, the Carrageens, we call it. And you have the River Pill down at the very end of that. Get the key to the back door, Thomas, and I'll just show Mary there for a minute. Come on. But at that time, sure, it was clay here as well, like we have it concrete, you know. Racing cart would have easily been able to come out there, and most of the lads would have carried it down. I'm sure there'd be great excitement, young lads helping out and all. It was a kind of an occasion when a boat would be launched. And on a summer's evening, about 2005, Thomas and myself and Sarah were on the bridge in Fidown just having a look in. And we met a man there, Shea Hurley, who was taking a few photographs. And we started talking, and he said he takes a big interest in the river. He's from Clonmel. And I just told him about my grandfather, who had built many boats and cots, etc.
And then this very same day, he invited me back. The same time, he invited me back to his house. He brought down this, the tin box, and then took out these notebooks, the jotters, as he called them. And I couldn't believe what I saw, because I would have been on the river myself quite a bit, since the time I was a child. And I've worked with boat builders, vernacular boat builders, that every boat he ever built, for the person he built it for, when he built it, the name of the boat, the materials that went into the boat, even down to how the boat handled, you know. But thank God that he had the good sense, if you like, to actually put this down on pencil and paper, with drawings. The drawings are lovely,
This is the famous biscuit tin now, where the little book originated from. Most of the stuff that you see is located in the biscuit tin, squashed in, but all the little notebooks and everything are there. And they contained all the different measurements of the various types of cots and boats that were made here, particularly the racing cots. This one, they made of iron scales, keel length 19 foot and 11 inches, frame spread 2 foot 10 inches, and all the various measurements. So that was for, particular different names we've come across here.
Shea produced a wonderful compilation of the notebooks, which captured within their pages the conception of so many of the champion racing cots. But they also gave an insight into the integrity and ambition of Cudahy himself.
I knew I had to do something special because Cudahy deserves it, in the sense of Cudahy is unique, at least to this point in time, in that he has left us a record of how these men functioned and what they worked with and the calibre of our work they produced,
History always comes across as a large element of simplification about what really goes on in people's lives, You take Cudahy in his period. The river that he was making his living from, much more alive than it is today, There was a complete shipbuilding heritage down in Waterford that had just ended. And it wasn't a dead or quiet trade, He was exposed to outside influences. He had racing crews coming from England to compete. It's not a question of being in a little backwater and, you know, toddling away, you know. It is, and there he was under pressure to perform, you know. He had to protect his reputation.
Ladies and gentlemen, I really want to give you a warm welcome to Greg na Mana for the 2011 regatta, sponsored by Waterways Ireland and Drinks Rising Tide. We have a great day.
At Greg na Mana Regatta, Ted Duff showed me around the boathouse, where programmes from previous regattas line the walls.
Yeah, can I show you the programme?
This is the earliest one, 1886. The Lass of Greg na Mana, the Parnell, the Butterfly, Home Rule. So there was a fair bit of history tied up in the regatta, if you can see, you know, Home Rule and Parnell being the names of cots. You had to go to the regatta dance to get your trophies on the night. I never remember. I mean, I'd never have seen that, but it must have been lovely. It must have been beautiful, yeah. You know? Catering and all, look.
Francis had arrived with his family. I found him inspecting one of the finished Thomastown cots with Davy.
She seems slightly narrower than the original Carrick shop, but she looks nice, a nice round in the front of her, and hold on one side and just paddle around on the other side.
Yeah.
And you keep yourself nice there. And then alter. Did you alter or not?
So are you going out?
I might. I don't know yet. I haven't my mind made up. Yeah, I haven't too. I haven't too. I don't know.
He just sees the water and gets this impulse.
I don't really.
But as the day wore on, it seemed the impulse won out. After weeks of speculation, Francis was going to paddle in a race that would see two new racing cots go head-to-head. He had found a racing partner in George Killeen, an old adversary from his racing days, and they were going up against Davy and Ray, expert canoeists half their age.
The entries in the two cots are Dave McCormack and Ray Hughes, and George Killeen and Francis Welch. Okay, lads, enjoy your day.
Well, Francis, any last words?
Last words? Geez, I'm contemplating now, I'll tell you the truth. I'm getting out. Last words. Well, it's great to have the racing cots back and we'll give them a good go.
Okay, Georgie, in reverse.
From the rope, lad, from the rope, up around the way back to the rope, all right?
From the off, Francis and George ripped through the water.
They're in the best cut.
You think so?
I put 1,000 quid in it.
Right.
And the good pullers.
Yeah.
What do you think of it?
Ah, fantastic. You can't beat the old styles. If you look at the economy of the stroke of Francie and Georgie, it's just amazing.
Perfectly synchronised paddling, strong strokes, there was no doubting who was in command on this river. Francis and George won by almost half the course. They waited at the finishing line to commiserate and give some advice to the younger paddlers. Then made for the riverbank.
You still have it, lad, you still have it.
Ah, Francis, have a sandwich, boy.
Yeah, and we actually made a mistake turning too, Butcher.
We got around it.
But we were enemies for what? 30 years, 20 years.
20 years anyway.
This is the first time we paddled together.
You saw the back of each other's heads, I'd say, for a long time.
Well, I see the back of his
head. Yeah. And I got a full-length one.
This is the first time ever.
What made you enemies?
Pulling against one another, racing against one another.
Just the fact we didn't like each other either.
No, then we were giving out to one another.
We were always giving out. Yeah, we spent most of our time giving out, didn't we?
We did, yeah. But still, we was the best of friends after the river. It's the very same as hurling.
Yeah, we always went for a few drinks.
Billy brought us for a long, long time, and we used to be second to Francis and Kieran. And then I won 5 years after Kieran and Francis giving it up,
and we were delighted.
Championships.
We were absolutely delighted that they did, because there were due an awful lot of races.
And I won with Frankie Fitzgerald.
We bet won tight races.
Another with Tom Hines. I won 3 with Paul Hamilton.
But this could be a great revival of racing cots again.
Of course.
I mean, the Greig lads will definitely build one. And I'd say there'll be one or two built in the ferry area as well. So if we got back between all of them again, you could have great racing in Thomastown and here again.
It's a pity we're getting old.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do about that. Did we leave it too long to come back?
You're not going.
Next year, please.
it's so important to keep it alive in whatever form. There's a sort of a generation now, once they pass all that sort of oral tradition, guys who talk in the corner of the pub passing on stories about great fishing places and stuff, that'll all be gone.
The sort of qualities that I kind of figured were that people were searching for, and maybe they still are in this country now, are ones about integrity, about honesty, about dependability, all of these things that have been sort of taken. And when you go to something like a boat, it's not alone metaphorically, but in itself, it has all of those things.
I remember we were fishing here, the last time we fished here in 2006 was the last night we fished here, a four-man crew. Myself and Michael Cullen, Pat, and Kevin, a son of mine. And we were fishing here, and I have never seen it ever before on the river. There were two kingfishers sitting on the branch of the trees just over there. Just at that area there, they were sitting up on the branch of the trees. They were fishing as well and watching us, and we were watching them as we were fishing down outside the lump here. And I haven't seen a kingfisher around the water since.
Thank you.